Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the December 1st, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Well, 'tis the season, as another Saturday has arrived for us to spend time putting up decorations, shopping for presents, and otherwise run around like crazy as the holiday countdown clock is ticking and showing 24 days remaining for before the big day. I hope that as you face your busy day today, you'll take time to listen in and join us as we spend the next hour talking about our nation's space program, with a particular emphasis today on what the Sunshine State is doing to ensure we continue to have a robust space program here in Florida. The Chief Operating Officer of Space Florida, former Navy Captain Jim Kuzma, is here with us in the studio today to help update us on what our state's space agency is up to. Plus, a little later on, we'll review the launch forecast and round out the program with our question and answer session that we call Terminal Count. As always, we welcome and appreciate any thoughts, questions, or comments you might have about our space program. Give us a call by dialing 321-768-1240. Or if you prefer to send us an email, the address is spacetalking@aol.com. Let's kick things off now with our more or less weekly broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations. Scientists this week announced that NASA's Messenger probe, launched from Cape Canaveral and now in orbit around Mercury, has confirmed the presence of ice on a planet whose daytime highs can reach 800 degrees Fahrenheit. The ice is located at Mercury's North Pole within deep craters that are forever in shadow, just like we recently confirmed on our own moon. Even more interesting, the instruments used to confirm the presence of ice on Mercury also appear to show that organic compounds are present. Now, it's likely that comets crashing into the planet are responsible for both the water ice and the organics. If you don't find that absolutely amazing, well, then I don't know what will. It seems that everywhere we look, on the moon, on Mars, on other moons, around other planets, and now on Mercury, we are finding evidence of water. And as the saying goes, where there is water, there could be life. Now, as we continue to consider the future steps we'll be taking in space during the decades to come, we must learn as we do that to take advantage of the fact that where there is water, there's, well, hydrogen and oxygen. And that can give us air to breathe, electricity, rocket engine propellant, and who knows what else. You know, there's a reason why we built so many towns near water as we settled this nation. It's so much easier to use what we find on the frontier rather than haul it from wherever we came from. We'll need to continue that tradition as we open up the space frontier. Hey, meanwhile, over at Mars, the Curiosity rover continues to look for evidence that life might have once existed on the red planet. But based on what happened this past week, I'm still searching for signs that intelligent life exists within certain members of the news media on our own planet. 11 days ago, Curiosity's chief scientist was interviewed in his office by NPR. He had been looking at information beamed back from Mars involving the rover's onboard chemistry lab, which is capable of detecting and identifying organic compounds in the rusty soil. Enthusiastic about the quality of the data the scientist was seeing and generally animated about the whole mission so far, he attempted to convey that excitement to the journalist interviewing him, saying, quote, "This data is going to be one for the history books." Well, NPR broadcast the interview, suggesting NASA was on the verge of an historic earth-shaking revelation. The story went viral, with dozens of media outlets repeating this story, adding more hype and speculation to each iteration of the telling. The story morphed from NASA has a big announcement to make soon, to NASA has proof there is life on Mars, to NASA is covering up a huge story, to it was all a misunderstanding, so never mind. Look, the space program needs all the public awareness and support it can get, especially at a time when so many people believe our space program is dead in the water following the space shuttle's retirement. But I just as soon see those reminders take the form of real news of real earth-shaking significance. In this case, we had a scientist who probably doesn't think like a journalist talking to, well, a journalist who probably doesn't think like a scientist. Both are supposed to be good at communicating, but neither was speaking each other's language. Now, as a former journalist, I've seen this happen time and again. I've probably even been guilty of it. Of course, back then, when I was a journalist, before the immediate deadlines of instant news published online had really taken hold, we had more time to figure things out and get it right. When I was a Florida Today reporter, we might see something reported in the Orlando Sentinel that we had missed and then have a whole day to chase down the story. We had time, and really only one competitor to worry about. Now, as I said, today's news media have instant deadlines to contend with and little time to be absolutely sure they have the story correct. Complicating matters, many feel obligated to respond to every hack with the website who thinks their opinion-filled, slanted, and sensationalized dribble passes for real journalism. And I say that as someone who, well, many at my own paper never believed that I ever was a real journalist because I had an aviation business degree and never went to a journalism school. Many felt I was never hard enough on those government dweebs at NASA who obviously don't know what they're doing, are wasting the taxpayers' money, and can't be trusted. Well, whatever secrets Mars has, they won't be revealed any sooner because the news media gets into a feeding frenzy and demands answers from NASA that just don't exist yet. Finally, this past week, some California congressmen have introduced legislation to rename NASA's Dryden Flight Research Center at Edwards Air Force Base for the late Neil Armstrong. Now, apparently this was attempted before in 2007 and failed, but with the passing this year of the first man to walk on the moon, I'm willing to bet there's going to be a lot more popular sentiment to approve the idea, but I would be disappointed if the change was made. Dryden is one of NASA's four aeronautical research field centers and presently is named for Hugh L. Dryden, the director of the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics at the time NASA was formed in 1958. He became the space agency's first deputy director and served in that capacity until his death in 1965. Dryden is a legend among the aeronautical innovators in our nation's history and was a key player in the discussion that led to President Kennedy setting the goal of landing a man on the moon. He managed the technical side of NASA, while Administrator James Webb saw to the politics and business side of the operation. Both Dryden and Armstrong have their place in the history books, and both deserve to be honored and never forgotten. Yes, Neil flew the X-15 from Dryden and worked on other aviation projects, but in my opinion, this isn't the place to put Armstrong's name on. In fact, I'm willing to bet Neil himself would be upset at the suggestion that his name would replace Dryden's at this important aviation-oriented NASA facility. I say let's be patient and find another prominent, more space-related national treasure to name in honor of Neil Armstrong, maybe perhaps a future spaceship or lunar probe. Or even better yet, let's dedicate ourselves and our resources to enabling a space program that puts a colony on the moon that's big enough to see from Earth by 2063. We could rename the Sea of Tranquility to Lake Armstrong, a gesture that I'm sure a few Star Trek fans might appreciate. In any case, NASA's Dryden Flight Research Center should retain its historic namesake, and public sentiment for honoring America's beloved moonwalker should be directed towards some other worthwhile memorial. And that's Orbital Inclinations for this week. Hey, we're going to talk about Space Florida with the agency's COO, Captain Kuzma, right after this break. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMVAM.com. If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. 321-768-1240, the number to call to participate in our program today. You can also send your questions or comments in an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Before we get to the topic at hand, I do want to make at least one more effort to plug the two books whose authors we spoke with a couple of weeks ago. Remind you that you can pick up American Missiles by Brian Nicholas at the gift shop in the Air Force Space and Missile Museum History Center on State Road 401 up in the port. And you can get Moon Hoax by Paul Gillibard. It's available online at moonhoaxbook.com, moonhoaxbook.com, where you can get 40% off the cover price of an autographed first edition. Just enter the code SPACETALK under the coupon code as you're checking out. Okay, that business aside, we'll get into our discussion today about Space Florida with our guest, Jim Kuzma. He is the Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of our state's space agency, no stranger to the Space Coast, as well as a former commander of the Naval Ordnance Test Unit, NOTU, out of Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, and we welcome the retired Navy Captain Jim Kuzma. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks, Jim. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Glad to have you here. Now, we send a shout-out to our boss, right, Frank DiBello, who was going to be on the program today, and basically more or less at the last minute gets called out of the country for business. I guess we'll let him deal with at some point in the future. But very nice of you to fill in and come in and talk, and we really appreciate not only Frank's personal support, but Space Florida's support of the program as a sponsor. So, Jim, with all that, kissing up, out of the way. First of all, I want to take advantage of the fact that you're here as a former Navy captain, because we very rarely get a chance to talk about the importance of the Navy in operations here at the Cape, the Space Coast. We never really get to hear about anything. Sometimes we see a little wispy trail go off our coast, as we did a few weeks ago. Tell us about how important the Navy is and really what the Navy is up to here at the Cape as a former NOTU commander.
Well, the Naval Ordnance Test Unit is responsible for all the Trident missile testing off of our ballistic missile fleet. I had the privilege of serving as commanding officer 3 years and 13 test launches from both coasts, from the East Coast and out at Point Magoo and in the Pacific.
Does NOTU manage those two, the West Coast ones?
Yes, sir. We actually, that was put together because the ships used to have to come over to the East Coast and the time away from operations was significant.
That makes sense.
So in order to do that, the strategic programs actually stood up a testing capability out of Point Magoo.
So every once in a while we see a submarine kind of slip in quietly. You do some work here and then it goes off the coast and does a demonstration launch.
Well, you have, we have the testing. The other thing you have is you have about 850 persons that support the strategic programs, either in the handling of the weapons or in integrated testing of each one of the systems, the navigation guidance, as well as the missile and some other stuff. They actually work with the systems, right? They do all the testing and procedures for handling it on both coasts at the handling facilities.
Okay.
As well as going through and look at all the upgrades.
Because you don't do the actual, let's say, arming, loading the missiles here, but you practice some of those procedures?
No, sir. There's just for basically shipping and that type of
okay.
The handling is actually done in Kings Bay, Georgia,
okay.
In Bangor, Washington.
So just to make a point clear, when the boats go out and shoot the missile, I've always kind of looked at it as saying, well, that's a test of the missile. I assume you get some good data out of that, but isn't it more about exercising the crew to fire the missile than the actual test of the hardware itself?
There's actually two types of tests. The first test is any platform that would go into the shipyard and come out loses its certification as a strategic asset. When they come out, the entire ship, both crews, as well as each one of the systems, gets put through a rigorous training period that's culminated by an actual successful launch. And once that's done, then the ship and the crews are certified to go back out and operate in support of the country. There's another test, though, that during the course of the year that we will take an asset that is currently out on patrol,
right,
and we'll bring it back to port. We'll put the testing equipment on board, and then we'll go out and do a no-notice test to go out and launch and actually go through the entire sequence from command and control through the actual operations to verify availability.
And it's those launches that take place more or less just off the horizon, just beyond the horizon as we see them here, and they're not announced, so every once in a while we get a phone call that says, you know, Cape just launched something, and we go running out and see what we can see. I had the pleasure once, Jim, of seeing a friend, shall we say, back in the good old days, said to me at one point, he said, he called me up and said, Jim, the hot dogs at Jetty Park are on sale between 4 and 5 o'clock this afternoon, you know. So you might want to go out there and have yourself a hot dog. And we went out there, and I think my dad was with one time, and the sun, it was in the wintertime, and the sun had just set, and it was dark. And to see that thing light up from behind the horizon was one of the most remarkable sights I've ever seen of a submarine launch. And, of course, we have the famous Trident, the first D-5, I think, was it the first one that launched that did the whippoorwill or whatever?
Yes, sir. I was in the Pentagon at that time.
Were you in the Pentagon at that time? Did you watch it live? Were you watching it?
I didn't, but I saw many replays and had the opportunity to be in many meetings.
My good friend Mike Brown, Florida Today photographer, former Florida Today photographer, got the shot. And it's framed on my living room wall. Not to take any great pleasure out of that, but just it was such an incredible shot. This basically what happened, folks. If you've never seen it, is this Trident missile clears the surface. It has to steer itself, and I guess it was a problem with the steering nozzle, and it jammed over and stuck, and the thing just started doing a pinwheel, and it was the most remarkable pictures that you've ever seen of a launch from the Cape. One last thing I want to ask you before we move on to Space Florida. We're spending a lot of time on the Navy here. But, you know, like you ask an astronaut, what's it like in space? I got to ask you this. For a couple of years, you were the captain, you were the commander of a nuclear-powered attack sub, the USS Boise. What's it like to be the commander of a submarine?
It's kind of like a little city. There's about 135 sailors on board, and believe it or not, about 65% of those are between 18 and 23.
Really?
And,
young guys.
And we worked to go out and deploy. And for I had the privilege of deploying for 6 months once and then deploying back at the beginning of Iraqi freedom to support our troops.
My middle boy was joining the Navy for a while, and there was some issues, and we won't get into that. But we were talking about what's it like to be in a sub. And a mutual friend of ours was giving us some advice, and he said, you know, just get used to the idea that as a submariner, every once in a while you're going to hear bang, shh, every once in a while, and that's the time to get nervous, and you'll hear it a lot. Did you ever experience this like that?
We do that a lot. We call them water slugs, where we practice actually shooting torpedoes.
Yeah.
That's the actual sound of the torpedo tube as it records.
It does this thing. That's incredible. Okay, well, let's move on to Space Florida. You left the Navy behind. You did some business. You did some things. Next thing you know, this past January, you joined the Space Florida team as the chief operating officer. Tell us about, just remind us what Space Florida is all about and kind of what your mission is.
Well, I think Space Florida, as you know, was established by the state. We're an independent special district of the state with a tremendous focus on space and aerospace business development. Kind of two facets of that. One is actually the business development. We can use our financing capabilities to defray upfront costs to bring companies here or allow them to expand. We also have an operations portion of that, of a spaceport authority, to look at operations of different facilities, similar to an airport authority. One of the things that's happened over the last year or so has been, in order to facilitate those business opportunities, we've been looking at repurposing a facility specifically out at Kennedy Space Center on the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because Space Florida, by being an independent district and the laws or whatever, the rules that are enabled by your existence, NASA can therefore turn over a piece of property to you, and then you therefore go lease it. You then go lease it to someone else, as opposed to, I think, forgive me if I'm not clear on the laws, for example, Lockheed Martin, in the operations and checkout building that now does the Orion spacecraft, was one thing. I think the OPF right now with Boeing is a good example.
With the CST-100,
Boeing couldn't necessarily do that directly with NASA, but they can do it with the state because the state can do it with the federal government. Is that the way to look at it?
That's correct. And then we can enter an agreement with the company to support that. We can also help them by purchasing equipment. And then there's obviously some payback to the state for its investment and what goes on. And we can do the same thing on the Air Force side, too. It's the same thing. There's a property agreement that we can enter with that the companies really couldn't, and we can act as a partner there.
And I think through the years and going back to when it was the Florida Space Authority and the Spaceport Authority, and I forget all the other names that it's had through the years, we really kind of got into it thinking that, you know, well, now you created this special Florida Authority that means you can just launch whatever you want commercially, and you don't have to go through the Air Force or NASA. You can just go through the state, and we're going to launch all these rockets, and that's what it's all about. And really, Space Florida evolved, and we can talk about the history a little bit later, but it really evolved to something different, and I think the financing part of it is a good example. But that's not all what you're about. Talk us more about what other things you're up to.
Well, we the Air Force are two launch complexes, Launch Complex 36 for liquid-fueled rockets and Launch Complex 46 for solid-fuel rockets that have been turned over by the Air Force to the state to support that. They're currently not in a position to be operational, but we do have an FAA license to launch from 46. One of the real focuses this year is to get 46 and 36.
We're going to talk some more about that in just a minute, Jim. Stand by, everybody. We're going to take our five-minute built-in hold here at the bottom of the hour. Get you caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports on a busy holiday weekend, shopping-wise anyway. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
Space Talk is back in a minute. Call Jim now at 768-1240. With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Bankey.
And welcome back again to our second half of Space Talk on WMMB. Phone lines are open. Online inbox is clear for your questions and comments. The phone number, 321-768-1240. The email address is spacetalking@aol.com. With us in the studio today is the Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer for Space Florida, the Sunshine State's space agency. That may not be a absolutely technically correct term to call you a space state agency, but that's what we do. Jim Kuzma is here, former Navy captain, former commander of NOTU here. And Jim, we were talking about, you know, Space Florida was always perceived to be this launch thing that you'd come in and do all these launches. You started talking about how Space Florida is involved at Complex 36 and Complex 46. I know that there's been some state money, I think, or some grant money that you've gotten to do some work out there too. What's going on at these launch complexes, and will we, do you think we will see launches that are quote unquote sponsored by Space Florida taking place from these facilities anytime soon?
We certainly are looking at that. There is some grants that are going to look at the communications systems at Launch Complex 46. We've also initiated an initiative to actually get the rest of the site ready to support launches, as well as Complex 36. There has been some operations out there. Masten has done some of their developmental testing on Complex 36, and they're looking to come back.
Masten, the launch provider?
Yes, sir. They are basically a vertical launch. They've been doing some tethered ops out there. And so I do think that it's kind of interesting there, though, that any launch from those locations are obviously in coordination with the 45th Space Wing,
right,
as a partner. And it's a great partnership to go through and look at that. I'll also tell you that we are looking to not necessarily eventually sponsor, but look at the horizontal launch commercial guys out of the shuttle landing facility.
Mm-hmm.
There's some lots of interesting discussions going on with there. Of course, X-Corps has made their announcement.
Sure.
And we're looking to see how we can help them in Sierra Nevada, too.
How's Strato launch looking these days?
They're out there.
He smiles.
There's many discussions that are going on.
I can imagine. I know Stratolaunch just made some news, dropped SpaceX in favor of orbital science. Stratolaunch is this interesting concept of basically welding together two 747 hulls with this big giant wing, and between the two hulls and the middle of the wing, you would sling a giant rocket. It's kind of like the Pegasus concept that Orbital Sciences flies with their L-1011. Or in the old days, you think of those lifting bodies or the X-15 being dropped from the wing of a B-52. This is taking it to a whole new scale, this giant aircraft dropping a rocket that's the size of, let's say, an Atlas V or a Falcon 9. And And the concept leads towards staging operations from the shuttle launch or shuttle landing facility, which you know, of course, are you guys bidding for that? NASA was kind of throwing that out there to see who would want to operate. Is that something Space Florida has partnered with anyone to do?
Well,
or?
We've responded to the request for information, and quite honestly, I think you know there's been a you know that our governance that we have. Our board, Space Force board, is made up of members from Enterprise Florida.
Right.
Chaired by Lieutenant Governor. There actually was a letter from Lieutenant Governor to Secretary LaHood and Administrator Bolden to turn over a couple pieces of property. The shuttle landing facility is one of those.
One of them, yeah.
And another location up toward the north part of Kennedy Space Center.
Well, let's talk about the Shiloh facility. There's been some talk about that in the papers and amongst the space community. This idea that Well, and to me, it goes a little history here. It goes back to this idea that, and I was part of the original governor's commission that formed Space Florida, took three old operations, kind of combined them into one. And one of the missions of that was going to be to enable commercial folks to come in and work efficiently and smoothly and conveniently with the 45th Space Wing to make sure that between the FAA rules, the 45th Space Wing, Eastern Range rules, that you, Space Florida, could kind of facilitate all that and help make things smooth. There still is, and rightly or wrongly, there still is a perception out there that the 45th Space Wing is difficult to work with commercial launches. Now, I know it's been vastly improved and I don't want anyone yelling at me saying and things still are bad out there, but there's still that sentiment, and we see it time and again, that people say, well, they want to launch off the Eastern Range. They want to get off the federal property because it was, quote-unquote, easier to launch by following FAA rules and not having to deal with being on a secure military launch base. Now, that's my interpretation. That's my setup for the question, and Jim, you can correct me where I'm totally wrong, but all that said, there is an interest in a piece of property down north of KSC up by Shiloh that says, let's put a commercial spaceport, a commercial launch pad there to fly. I don't know who the customer is, and maybe you do and you can't say now yet, but talk a little bit about what's going on that.
I think the first thing is, given my experience as NOTU, I had 3 years to work with the 45th Space Wing, and they've done a tremendous job of encouraging the commercial the commercial partners to come in and work, and I think SpaceX would be the first to tell you that they do a great job. I think you also know that our focus is not on the federal and government launches; it's on the commercial launch industry,
right.
And those guys want some degree of autonomy, right, to look at it. And certainly, looking at under the FAA Office of Commercial Space Transportation, there's no difference in safety. It's strictly an implementation.
And I agree with that, and I know that firsthand, having worked on some stuff with when I was with SAIC, that, you know, you compare those two sets of rules, and they're virtually the same, just sometimes different terms and different forms to fill out.
So, you know, if as the state's space development agency, we've tried to respond to the market being driven by a few of the pioneers.
Yeah.
And one of the discussions was for them to go toward Texas for their commercial launches.
Yeah.
Right. And our initiative is designed to, right, win that business here to the commercial business here to Florida and not let it go to Texas. And that's
kind of where that's aiming. So there's this talk about going to Texas. SpaceX has been visible. Other folks have looked at other sites around the nation. We feel as a state, we need a facility to handle vertical launches in a commercial, non-federal spaceport setting. And this piece of property, is it north of KSC's property? I mean, is Shiloh actually
north?
It's still on KSC property, north of Launch Pad 39B.
Yeah, and the request from the Office of the Governor was to turn the property, both properties, over by Public Benefit Command.
Yeah, okay. So we'll see where that goes. So how does that all – so now we talked about a lot of different things. So let's talk more specifically about the year 2013. What are your – top plans, priorities for next year as you see them and as you're explaining to folks in the community?
We've been looking, there's been lots of discussion from those horizontal launch customers. We're looking to partner with NASA, KSC, to be able to bring that facility up to a commercial use, things like fueling capabilities, some of the taxiways, mm-hmm. right, the ramps. We've also engaged with discussions looking at to support heavy lift operations, right, with respect to some of our customers, and we're going to get 46 and 36 ready to go. There's another big focus, too, I think, the Space Life Science Lab out there.
Oh, sure,
Park,
sure, good point.
With the gate being moved such that it's no longer access can be granted through that, we're looking forward to the first building to begin groundbreaking on that first building. I think if you were out there for Atlantis, the Exploration Park was highlighted.
Yeah.
The infrastructure's out there. The state made the investment for the infrastructure and the roads. And we're really looking forward to the groundbreaking. Hopefully late. It'll be late in the year, but we're looking forward to that first building going up and continue to develop that.
Yeah, that Space Life Sciences building, incredible facility, incredible asset for KSC to have and for our community to have. And it's one of those little things, and you alluded to it just to spend a moment to explain. We built this great facility and then put it inside the security fence at KSC so that it was very difficult. It made it more difficult than it needed to be for a lot of folks to get in and off, to use it in the kind of a commercial, quote-unquote, way that that probably would have been best, more efficient way to use it. So, moved the fence.
We moved the fence, and again, in a partnership with KSC,
yeah.
We moved the fence, and we're
so
looking
smart.
To help use the nation's International Space Station Lab for a different science.
A couple of minutes, Jim. Let's talk really quick a little bit about some of your education stuff, because I know education is still an important part of what Space Florida does. You've got a variety of different things going on supporting. Can you talk, just give us a high-level overview of what you're doing there?
We've been doing different – we have many different initiatives with the universities, UCF, Florida, Florida Tech, Embry-Riddle,
right.
Florida State, all around the state. I'll also tell you that one of our initiatives is with the Unmanned Systems and the FAA test site for Unmanned Systems. And in that effort, we have relationships with pretty much every all the big universities, South Florida, Central, right, Northwest Florida. They're all part of that, and we're figuring out how to enable those different things. We also have some there was a NanoSat challenge effort that I think unfortunately has been derailed, and we're seeing how to recover that.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is that we do have relationships for research and development inside the Space Life Science Lab that we've reached back out, now that it's outside, to bring more of the universities into.
And you made some grant announcements this past week.
That's correct.
Our friend Sam Durant's got a grant, I know, to work on some stuff, a former payload specialist astronaut. So,
I think that's one of the things that we talk a lot about launch, but I think, as you know, Frank has been on a diversification.
Sure.
Right, looking at technologies and opportunities that will go to and from space, whether it's in the area of materials, clean energy, applications, cybersecurity, robotics, all those kind of things. And it's a real focus on not just launch, but the supply chain to bring jobs here. That's our real focus, is to bring jobs, manufacturing, and bring those here to Florida, and specifically here on the Space Coast.
Yeah, and again, to follow up on that, it is more than just, and we've been preaching that for a long time, it is more than just launch. It can't just be launch. It's got to be about everything that goes into space operations and the space program. And again, as important as the Space Coast is, it's got to be for the entire state. We are just as interested in what's going on up in Panama City as we are in Key West, as we are in the Space Coast. Jim, stand by. We're going to take our final break of the day. When we come back, we'll check in with our weekly launch forecast. We'll wrap up our conversation, and we'll put Jim through the ringer that is called Terminal Count. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk here on WMMB.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com. Listen to Space Talk on the web at WMMBAM.com.
And welcome back again as we begin this final segment of today's edition of Space Talk, with your reminder that you can stay in touch with us online throughout the week using some of the more popular social media sites. I can't get to them all. My favorites, of course, your first stop, WMMBAM.com on the web, keywords Space Talk. Where there you can find the archive of past Space Talk shows, recording MP3 files for you to download, text versions of our orbital inclinations. You can also follow us online with Twitter. The handle there is Space Talking. Can you say the handle with Twitter? Is that just too old, 70 CB-ish? I don't know. I'm going to find out the protocol on that. And then also we have a Space Talk page on Facebook as well that you certainly are invited to like along the way. Before we get back to Jim, we're going to talk a little bit about when the next launch is from the Cape. And again, We're not saying anything new here that we haven't said before, at least the last couple of weeks. No change for the plans now, as the Atlas V rocket remains reserved with a date on the eastern range of December 11th. That launch vehicle scheduled to carry the Air Force's X-37B orbital test vehicle, mini space plane, we like to call it. Third mission of that particular program, and a repeat of the first orbiter who flew, and then this is the repeat of that first orbiter, so it's going back into space a second time. Great mission, great project by the Air Force. Takes off as a rocket from here at the Cape, lands like a plane at Vandenberg Air Force Base, and what's old is new again, I guess. In any case, that launch still on the range for December 11th. However, we still have not yet officially heard that a problem with an upper stage, an RL-10 rocket stage, that there was an issue with during a Delta launch in October, has been cleared technically yet. So although the United Launch Alliance is holding to December 11th and working toward that date, we still don't have a resolution on the problem, at least one that's been publicly announced yet that we're aware of. So we'll continue to track that and keep an eye on things, let you know. Because everything kind of got bumped the way it did, things are stacking up for launches early next year. Right now, at least the forecast shows a Delta IV military communications satellite launch in January, basically mid-January, Atlas V launch with a NASA tracking data relay system satellite toward the end of the month. 2 weeks after that launch, another Atlas V launch from California, which just means that our ULA friends are going to be very busy during the month. And then in mid-February, that takes place. And then looking now at the next Falcon 9 launch to the space station on March 1st, that launch itself delayed because of its own issues following the last Falcon 9 launch when they lost one of the nine engines during the climb uphill. As always, we'll keep an eye on things and try to keep you up to date each week. In the meantime, for more information about these and all the various other launches scheduled around the world, and boy, there's a lot of them out there, including a Soyuz launch from South America tonight, still on the books, and South Korea still trying to get their first rocket into orbit. You can go online to the web, WMMBAM.com, keyword space talk, and look for the link to our launch forecast. All right, with our remaining few minutes left, it's time for Terminal Count, the feature at the end of our program in which we're going to ask our guests five simple questions to get to know them a little bit better. Again, the rules. This is not a quiz. There are no right or wrong answers, Jim. This is not a contest, so please, no wagering. All right, Jim Kuzma, CEO of Space Florida, former Navy captain, is going to tell us now, what is the coolest rocket?
I think it's SpaceX Falcon 9.
SpaceX Falcon 9, okay. First launch that you saw in person or that you remember is particularly memorable.
When I was 11 years old, I came down to the space, down to Kennedy Space Center, and saw one of the Apollo.
No, you saw a Saturn V launch.
Saturn V.
Wow. Okay. See, I'm always envious of people that have seen a Saturn V. I never saw one. I saw Apollo 16 on the pad as a kid, but never saw one launch, and I envy people. I guess it's the way people feel who are younger than us who don't know what it's like to watch a man walk on the moon. Must have been something.
And then I got a chance to watch the last 13 shuttle launches, so I was pretty happy
about
that.
That's pretty cool, yeah, yeah. All right, most prized space memorabilia.
I have a No-2 coin that was flown up on a shuttle. There's a submarine, the only submarine or astronaut, Steve Bowen.
Steve
Bowen,
yeah.
Took it up, and Steve brought it back down to us.
And presented it to, oh, that's cool.
And he also made one of my supply officer, he promoted him to lieutenant junior grade at that time.
Oh, really? At that same time at the presentation ceremony?
Sure.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Okay. Best space TV series or movie?
I Dream of Jeannie.
Oh, bless you. Yeah, the late Larry Hagman. We got to say goodbye to Tony Nelson, right? Yeah. I Dream of Jeannie was one of those great TV shows that got everything wrong, but it was so much fun to watch. You know, I always loved, especially when we finally moved to Florida and I'd rewatch the show and see all these mountains in the background as they were shopping in downtown Cocoa Beach. Always loved that. Okay. Well, here you go from a Navy guy. Moon, Mars, or beyond?
Beyond.
Beyond. Where would you like to go? Where do you think where would you like to go? Where would you like to go out in space? What sounds cool to you?
I just think the idea of going up.
Just going beyond.
I just think that, early on, you look at all the different things that have come from space, that the challenge of doing that will take care of address a lot of the issues of resources and things that we have here. And I think it's a great thing for us to go figure out how to use that technology to help the world and address problems that are going to come up over the next few centuries.
It seems like, you know, we talk about going to the moon, we talk about going to Mars, and it just always seems to me so limiting because it's like it's just a destination. They worry about the destination. It's always the next destination. And a theme, Jim, that I've been kind of recurring here lately is that I think we need more capability built into the system so we can go wherever we want, because it's not just – we're not going to stop at Mars. After that, it's the next thing out. It's the moon of Jupiter, and then they're on so
far. I was actually had a chance to introduce at the Space Week up yesterday with the kids from Brevard.
Right.
And astronaut Jim Riley was talking about going to Mars and how it's going to be, you know, 3 or 4 months up, and they're going to be growing food right on their way and doing this. And so when you start looking at fuel cell technology, energy technologies, radiation, basically shielding and different things, as well as growing food, and I just think that there's tremendous value to what's going to happen here on Earth.
Space Week's a great program, by the way. We'll plug it some more next week, but a chance for every sixth grader in the county to get to the visitor complex, a good thing. Jim, thanks so much for being on the program with us and filling in for Frank DiBello. Our best to Frank as he travels and makes business happen for the state, and good luck and best wishes to you and your team.
Thank you for this opportunity and for being a great friend of Space Florida.
Okay, well, you bet, Jim. Thanks a lot. Okay, that's next week on Space Talk. We're going to be joined once again by Elliot Pullum of the Space Foundation. Elliot was just on the program a few weeks ago but is returning because this week the foundation plans to release a report that they've written that addresses some of the problems NASA faces as it plans for its future and, more importantly, offers some ideas for solutions. You know, and from what I'm hearing, this is not going to be one of those typical studies that argues for reaching for one more particular destination over another, but it's going to get at the very heart of why we need a space program and how we can get there. I guarantee you won't want to miss it. That is it for now. Space Talk is a production of Milo Solutions and is brought to you thanks to the generous help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus Technology, SpaceX, United Launch Alliance, and Lockheed Martin. My thanks to Sean Williams for manning the ops station for today's program. Please join us next Saturday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for another hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now as WMMB presents a weekend edition of the Glenn Beck program. I'm Jim Bankey, and we'll talk to you again real soon.